What can the author of Hobbits and Wizards teach us about faith, war, and holding on to hope in the darkest times? Today, we're stepping into the life of J.R.R. Tolkien, a soldier, a scholar, a Catholic, and the creator of Middle Earth. From the trenches of World War I to late night walks with C.S. Lewis at Oxford, Tolkien's story is one of faith, loss, and imagination. His life reminds us that even in the darkest times, courage, fellowship, and hope can endure. I'm Laurelee Siemens, and this is the Church History Podcast. Today we're talking about John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, known by his family and friends as Ronald. Knowing church history matters because it reminds us that faith has endured through centuries of trials and triumphs and transformations. It gives us courage to stand firm today, just as those who did before us. If you would like to support this podcast and continue exploring these incredible stories, you can do so by purchasing one of my books on church history. And here is a short advertisement. My new book, The Church is Corrupt, is available for order. I previously published the book, The Church is Born, which was part one in our series, and that delved into the creation of the church. But my second book picks up where the first one left off. It offers a unique and insightful perspective on the church's journey. Discover the rich history of the church, its triumphs, its failures, and its heroes. In this second book in the series on church history, we journey through the pivotal moments that shaped Christianity as we know it. From the foundational theology of the early church to the inspiring lives of great men and women who boldly stood for their faith. Explore the church's role during the Crusades, the Inquisitions, and even the discovery of America. Learn how over centuries, the church began to slowly lose its way, setting the stage for the monumental changes just before the Protestant Reformation. With each chapter highlighting a different story, you're going to be inspired by the heroes of our faith and challenged to reflect on the lessons from the church's successes and its stumbles. Whether you're a seasoned historian or just beginning your exploration of church history, this book offers valuable insights for everyone. Both books, The Church is Born and The Church is Compromised, are available on Amazon for you to order. So if you haven't gotten the first book, why not get both today and delve into the comprehensive understanding of the church's journey? In 1892, life for a white family in South Africa carried both comfort and challenges. Families often enjoyed relative wealth. Their days were marked by familiar British or Boer rhythms, afternoon tea, Sunday church gatherings, and the steady work of farms or small urban trades. Yet beneath all that sense of order did run some tensions. There was rivalry between the British and the Boers. There was land disputes, and the unrest stirred up rapid change. There was the discovery of gold and diamonds that drew fortune seekers from across the world, bringing new opportunities but also instability. Homes were modest but comfortable and decorated with European goods shipped across oceans. Children were educated at home and trained for lives connected to the land or for the possibilities of the growing cities. And it was here on January 3rd, 1892, in South Africa, that John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, known to his family simply as Ronald, was born. Just days later, his parents took him to the Anglican church where he was baptized into the Christian faith. And though he didn't remain in South Africa for long, this early beginning set his life within the rhythm of the church and a foundation that would remain with him through all the twists and trials that lay ahead. 1895. At just 3 years old, little Ronald clutched his mother's hand as he and his younger brother prepared to leave South Africa behind. The heat, the endless skies, and the smell of the trees would soon be replaced by the gray drizzle of England. On the docks, his father, Arthur, carefully painted their names onto the family suitcase. Small act of love to ensure nothing would be lost on the long voyage. He promised his wife and children he would follow soon, that they would be reunited in England. For Ronald, it was the last memory he carried of his father, a figure bent over the luggage steady and hopeful as the family boarded the ship and sailed into this unknown future. But tragedy struck in 1896. While Mabel and her two young sons were visiting family in England, Arthur Tolkien, who worked as a bank manager in Africa, fell ill with rheumatic fever. In a letter to his wife, he admitted that his condition was serious, yet he insisted on staying at his post rather than joining them, and within weeks, his health collapsed. He had a severe hemorrhage, and that took his life on February the 15th, 1896. The devastating news reached Mabel and the boys in England, leaving them stunned and heartbroken. Ronald would never again see his father. Arthur's death not only robbed the family of a husband and father, but also their financial stability. From that moment on, Mabel was left to raise her sons alone, a burden that would profoundly shape the course of Ronald's childhood and faith. After Arthur's death, Mabel Tolkien made the life-altering decision to never return to South Africa. In the years after Arthur's death, Mabel gathered her two young sons and moved in with her parents in Birmingham. The house was respectable, and her Methodist family did give her a place to stay, but not the comfort her grieving heart needed. Mabel was searching for peace, for answers in the face of her loss. The Methodist church, familiar though it was very cold and unyielding. But it was in the quiet reverence of a Catholic Mass that she finally felt something break open, a place where her sorrow could rest, where she sensed love instead of rules. Slowly, she began attending more regularly, and then brought her boys, and that was the breaking point. Her parents were outraged. Attending Mass in their eyes was betrayal. Eventually, they forced her out of their home. Arthur's Baptist relatives joined the protest, cutting off any little financial help that they had given. Then Mabel made the decision permanent. She was received into the Catholic Church, and she had her boys baptized. It was an act of conviction that would define her life. And it came at tremendous cost. She was now alone, impoverished, with two small boys to raise. She clung to the faith that gave her hope, even as nearly everyone she knew turned their backs on the family. Cast off by both sides of the family, Mabel had no choice but to leave the city behind. She was homeless and penniless, and she took Ronald and his brother Hillary to a place called Sarehole, a small Worcester village, quiet and green. Life there was simple, almost rustic. A water mill creaked nearby, fields stretched wide, hedgerows twisted along country paths. For Ronald, this was paradise. Mabel poured herself into her son's education. She became both mother and teacher, tutoring them at home. And Ronald quickly proved to be a bright pupil. He absorbed his lessons in botany. He learned to recognize the textures and beauty of plants. And he was so delighted by the way leaves curled and flowers unfolded. But what thrilled him the most were words. Under his mother's careful hand, he learned to write, his letters curling in a style that would influence the script for the rest of his life. She introduced him to Latin, strange, beautiful words that opened the door to other languages. And she taught him poetry, and in doing so, Mabel was planting seeds, a love of learning, a love of beauty, and a love of language that would one day bloom into a legend. For young Ronald and his brother Hillary, Sarehole was more than a place to live. It was a world of wonder. The village was small and unassuming, with its quiet mill and country lanes and open fields. But to a child's imagination, it was alive with possibilities. Sarehole would later become the model for the Shire, the beloved homeland of hobbits. Its simple beauty and its sense of rootedness and community became the foundation of Tolkien's vision of what a home should look like. Just beyond the village lay Moseley Bog. To an adult, it looked like just a tangled wet woodland, patches of fern and mossy ground. But to Ronald and Hillary, it was enchanted. There was twisted trees and strange shadows, the calls of unseen birds. This was the boys' playground, their secret kingdom. Years later, Ronald would describe it as a lost paradise. Out of Moseley Bog grew the ancient, mysterious forests of Middle-earth, the old forests, and even haunted woods where adventure began. It was here in Sarol and in Mossley Bog that the boy's world was being shaped. It was a quiet, rural place that became the beating heart of one of the greatest fantasy worlds ever written. Ronald and his younger brother Hillary spent hours exploring the tangled woods and hidden corners of Mossley Bog. To them, it wasn't just a patch of woodland. It was a world waiting to be discovered. They invented stories. They built adventures. They filled the landscape with imagination. The peaceful village of Sarol and the mysterious bog became the seedbed of Middle-earth. In 1904, tragedy struck again. Ronald was just 12 years old when his mother, Mabel, fell gravely ill. Earlier that year, she'd been diagnosed with diabetes, a death sentence at that time. Insulin would not be discovered for another 20 years. Living in a small, rented cottage, Mabel's health rapidly declined until, at age 34, she died. For Ronald and Hillary, it was crushing. They'd already lost their father and now their mother, who was their teacher, their protector, and their anchor of their faith, and now gone. But Mabel's influence didn't fade. She had instilled in her son a deep devotion to the Catholic faith, even at great personal cost. For the rest of his life, Tolkien would view her as a martyr for that faith, a woman who endured hardship and isolation because she believed in the truth of the church. Her death left the boys orphans, but not abandoned. A Catholic priest named Father Francis Morgan stepped in as their guardian and became the steady hand and spiritual guide for the years ahead. Their mother had made Father Morgan their legal guardian. She knew her boys would need more than just a roof over their heads. They would need their faith to be preserved, and Father Morgan promised to raise them, and he took that responsibility to heart. But the boys' childhood became a patchwork of homes. Sometimes they lived with relatives, other times in boarding houses, all arranged by Father Morgan. They moved through different neighborhoods they lived in, Lady Woods, Duchess Rose, and later Highfield Road. The stability of any permanent home was gone, but Father Morgan always made sure that they were cared for and provided for, and he gave them something, consistency of faith, encouragement in their education, and a steady reminder that they were never alone. For Ronald, the kindness of this priest left a mark that stayed with him for his entire life. At King Edward School in Birmingham, Ronald found something he had long been missing, a band of brothers. With his friends, Christopher, Robert, Geoffrey, he formed what they jokingly called the Tea Club and Barovian Society, or the TCBS. The boys would gather in school libraries or at Borough stores, a local shop. They would drink tea, share poetry, and dream of the future. But the TCBS quickly became more than just pastime. These four young men were bound together by the love of words and a sense of purpose. They wrote, they debated, they laughed, and in time, they saw themselves as something larger. They were a fellowship. Ronald would later say that TCBS was not just a group of friends, they were family. And in those years, they were inseparable. In 1908, Ronald and his brother Hillary were placed in a boarding house for orphans, and among the other residents was a young woman named Edith Bratt. She was 3 years older than Ronald, but that hardly mattered. What mattered was that they shared the same loves, music, theater, literature. The two bonded quickly, and soon they were inseparable. But Father Francis Morgan noticed. He saw the closeness growing, and he was worried. Ronald was still a young teenager, and Edith a young woman. 3 years is little in the life of an adult, but in adolescence, it could mean the difference between maturity and immaturity. Father Morgan believed Ronald had the potential to do great things, and he didn't want an early romance to derail that promise. He gave Ronald a rule, no relationship with Edith until he came of age. That was not what Ronald wanted to hear. He cared deeply for Edith, and the thought of waiting felt unbearable. But he trusted Father Morgan, so reluctantly he obeyed, choosing discipline over desire. That decision, painful as it was, would shape the course of his life and his love story. By the time Ronald stepped into adulthood and prepared for college, he'd already endured more loss than most people face in a lifetime. His father had died suddenly. His extended family had turned their backs on him. His mother had suffered a slow and painful death, and he'd been shuffled through boarding houses and group homes. His world had been marked by instability, grief, and abandonment. But one thing had never wavered: the Catholic Church. For Ronald, the church was not just a place of worship, it was his lifeline. It was his connection to his mother, who had loved him fiercely and taught him to pray, to study, and to believe. Holding fast to her memory meant holding fast to her faith. To him, Catholicism was bound up with love and sacrifice, while Protestantism was tied to rejection and estrangement. That early association left its mark, and throughout his life, Tolkien would remain steadfastly devoted to the Catholic Church, his loyalty unshaken, even in the moments of doubt or difficulty. In 1911, Ronald arrived at Exeter College in Oxford. A 19-year-old orphan stepped into one of the most prestigious universities in the world. Oxford was steeped in tradition, ivy-covered stone walls, formal lectures, small tutorials where students wrestled with Greek and Latin texts. Students walked the ancient quads in their academic gowns, attended chapel, dined in great halls lit by candlelight. It was a place where history pressed in on every side. For Ronald, Oxford was both exhilarating and exhausting. He was living on a modest scholarship, supported somewhat by Father Francis Morgan, and money was tight. But in the midst of all those struggles, he had found his place. He joined the essay club, made new friendships, and discovered a world of ideas and stories. Though he began in classics, his true love was language itself, the study of words and their histories. In the rhythms of Oxford life, surrounded by books and debates and the stirrings of modern England, where horse-drawn carriages shared streets with new motor cars, Ronald laid the foundation of the mythology that one day he would create. And those new motor cars, he hated them. Actually, for his entire life, he hated cars. He thought no one needed to go anywhere that fast. But amongst all of this, looming just ahead, was a shadow none of them could escape: the coming of war. In 1914, Ronald Tolkien was 22 years old, a student at Oxford. The world around him was shifting. His Catholic faith, so central to his identity, made him different in this largely Anglican halls of the university. He wrestled with questions of doubt and belief. He wrote letters to Francis Morgan, searching for strength in a world that suddenly felt very unsteady. Then came August, and the newspaper screamed with headlines of war. His closest friends in the Tea Club and Barrovian Society, Christopher, Robert, and Geoffrey, enlisted almost immediately. It was only Ronald who stayed behind, choosing to finish his degree. That choice set him apart, and he felt it. Around him, duty to king and country pulled young men into uniforms, while he remained at his desk with books and languages. And he was being judged, and he feared that judgment. Worse than that, he feared losing his friends, who would become his family. Financially, he was stretched thin. Now the war brought new uncertainty, and with it, pressure he could not escape. In the quiet hours, he poured his turmoil into his writing. Early visions of myths and legend began to take shape, fragile beginnings of the world that would one day become Middle Earth. The war pressed in on every side, but rather than extinguish his faith, it drove him deeper, rooted him in the church that had always been his refuge. By 1916, Ronald Tolkien had kept his promise to Father Morgan. He had waited through his teenage years, and now at 24, he was free to be with the woman he loved. That year, in a small Catholic ceremony, he married Edith Bratt. Their union was deeply influenced by Father Morgan, whose guidance had shaped Ronald's life and faith. For Ronald, Edith was more than a wife. She was the anchor he clung to in this storm that was engulfing the world. That same year, Tolkien put on the uniform. England in 1960 was a country that had been transformed by war. Oxford's spirals stood still. The lecture halls were empty, the familiar hum of students' chatter replaced by silence. The young men who had once debated poetry with him were gone. Across the city, posters plastered to stone walls urged men to enlist, while the streets filled with a shuffle of wounded veterans, their empty sleeves and limping steps, a sobering reminder of what the war had demanded. Tolkien's path was set. He would leave his new wife behind, carry a commission, and join his brothers in arms on the journey towards France, toward the firestorm of the Great War. July 1st, 1916, the first day of the Battle of Somme, at dawn, whistles pierced the air, and thousands of young men surged over the top. Among them was Robert Gilson, Tolkien's closest friend from the Tea Club and Barrovian Society. At just 22 years old, Robert Gilson led his platoon across the shattered earth. A shell exploded, and just like that, Robert was gone. In one morning alone, nearly 60,000 British soldiers became casualties. 19,240 of them were killed in that one morning. And among those dead was Robert Gilson. Weeks later, Ronald heard the news through the letter. By then, Ronald Tolkien himself was already in France, serving as a signals officer. The letter told him what he dreaded to hear. Robert had fallen. The death hit him like a blow. Robert was more than a friend. He was a brother, part of the fellowship that believed they were destined to bring beauty and meaning into a world of darkness. But now, that fellowship was breaking. The Somme had shattered not only bodies, but also the illusion of invincibility. For Tolkien, the war was no longer just a great historical event. Now it was personal. It was cruel. It was devastating. And yet in the shadow of Robert's death, a resolve deepened in him to carry forward the vision the TCBS had once started, to make something enduring out of their sacrifice. December the 3rd, 1916, Jeffrey Smith, one of Ronald's closest friends and a brother in the Tea Club and Barrovian Society, lay in a casualty clearing station in France. Just days earlier, on November 29th, he'd been struck by shrapnel from a German shell. It seemed survivable. His legs were wounded, but he was still writing and still speaking. And his friends believed he would recover. By mid-1916, Ronald Tolkien was on the Western Front. He was a signal officer. His task was to keep communications alive. He was stringing wires through trenches, repairing lines under fire, making sure messages reached men who depended on them. It was a dangerous work. Around him was the nightmare of war, endless mud that swallowed boots and bodies alike, rats that gnawed at the dead, and the constant terror of shells overhead. Disease lurked in every puddle, and death was never far away. The war weighed on him, not just with its dangers, but with its grief. The Tea Club and Barrovian Society, the fellowship, was crumbling. Robert was gone, Jeffrey was dying, and back in Oxford, Edith waited, clinging to the hope of letters, praying each knock on the door wasn't the telegram she dreaded. Their love story, barely begun, is being tested by separation and fear. The trenches carried invisible killers in all the filth and mud. Infection set in. Jeffrey, who was trying to heal from his badly injured leg, became infected. Gangrene spread quickly. The doctors could do nothing. Within 4 days of getting gangrene, Jeffrey was gone. For Tolkien, the news came shortly afterward from a letter, and by then Ronald himself had been pulled from the front. He was now sick with trench fever. Away from that mud and mire, the war still found him. Robert Gilson had fallen in July, and now Jeffrey Smith was dead too. Jeffrey had once written to Tolkien, urging him to carry on the work that they had dreamed of, the work of bringing beauty into the world, with Geoffrey's death only to remain, Ronald and Christopher. The fellowship of the TCBS, once so full of hope and promise, is now broken. And for Tolkien, the weight of their absence was crushing. But it was also a call to create something that would last, something that would honor his friends who never came home. In the autumn of 1916, Ronald's body finally gave way. After months in the trenches and after dealing with trench fever, it became too much, and he was pulled and sent home. In early November, he arrived back in Birmingham, pale and exhausted, and admitted into the hospital, not sure if he would survive. But there, away from all the mud and terror, he began to slowly recover. And at last, Edith was there. The reunion brought relief, but also a reminder of the grief. Ronald returned home not the same man who had left. He was now a soldier, scarred by loss. Two of the brightest stars of his fellowship, Robert Gilson and Geoffrey Smith, were gone, and that absence hung over him. The fever had taken him out of the war, but had given him something amazing: time. Time to recover, to be with Edith, to begin shaping stories that stirred within him. While recovering from trench fever, Tolkien had a moment that shaped his personal life and mythology. One afternoon, he watched Edith as she danced in the flowers, and that image stayed with him forever, and it became the heart of one of his greatest stories, named Brienne and Lúthien. It was a tale where Lúthien, an immortal elf maiden, chose to give up her immortality for the mortal man she loved, Beren. For Tolkien, Edith was his Lúthien, and he was her Beren. It was their love story, and he wrote it into a myth, a reminder that even in the shadow of war and death, love could still triumph. In November 1917, amidst all the lingering shadows of war, Ronald and Edith welcomed their first child, John Francis Rural Tolkien. His birth was more than just a family milestone. It was a glimmer of healing. For Ronald, still haunted by the war and loss of his friends, holding his son brought a joy back into the world he didn't think he would ever have again. By the 1920s, Tolkien's life began to steady. He joined the Oxford faculty. He immersed himself in the world of academia. Here in the rhythm of lectures and tutorials and libraries filled with ancient texts, Ronald found purpose and delight. His passion for a language, their roots, and their stories was no longer just a personal obsession. It became his vocation. Family grew alongside his work. In 1920, Edith gave birth to their second son, Michael Hilary Rural. 4 years later, in 1924, their third child, Christopher John Rural, was born. But Tolkien's home was full of noise, laughter, and the demands of small children. But even amid all the academic rigor and family life, Ronald's imagination was still stirring. The stories that had begun in the war did not fade. They grew and matured by both his scholarship work and his fatherhood. In 1926, Ronald Tolkien crossed paths with another Oxford scholar who would change his life, Clive Staples Lewis, known simply as Jack. We covered the story of Jack in our last episode, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Their friendship began with shared passion, myths, literature, storytelling. Soon they were part of a circle of writers and thinkers who called themselves the Inklings. Week after week, they gathered either in Jack's room or in their favorite bar, the Eagle and Child Hub, which they nicknamed the Bird and Baby. Ronald and Jack had a lot in common. Both had lost their mothers young. Both had endured lonely years in boarding schools and homes. Both had escaped into imagination and created entire worlds in childhood play. And both carried a fierce love for language and story. But there was one place where they were very different. Jack was skeptical and was stunned that someone as brilliant as Ronald could believe in God. To Jack, faith seemed like a fairy tale clung to by children. He pressed Ronald with questions and was confident he would be able to dismantle this belief. But Ronald was ready. Years of training under Father Francis Morgan had given him not only knowledge, but conviction. When Jack asked hard questions, Ronald was thoughtful, firm, and answered. Their conversations stretched late into the night. Myth and theology, literature and belief. For Jack, these debates began to plant seeds of doubt. About his doubt. For Ronald, they were a chance to live out the faith he had clung to through grief and war. Ronald had always loved trees. To him, they were more than just part of the landscape. They were a living parable of God's designs. Trees were deeply rooted, drawing strength from something you couldn't see. They grew tall and strong. They reached upward, pointing towards heaven. And in their season, they bore fruit. That, Ronald believed, was the life of faith should be, rooted, resilient, pointing to God, bearing fruit that blessed others. His friendship with Jack was such a tree. What began as spirited debates and evenings of laughter at the pub grew into something steady and enduring. Jack pressed Ronald's faith, and Ronald answered with patience and conviction. And slowly, Jack's skepticism began to crack. And like a tree breaking through hard ground, something new began to grow in him. Ronald's rootedness, his quiet strength, was bearing fruit in the life of his closest friend. In 1929, Priscilla Mary Ann Real Tolkien was born. It was the couple's only daughter. Ronald loved his family dearly and his family life. It was September 1931, a cool evening in Oxford. Ronald Tolkien walked side by side with his friends, Jack Lewis and Hugo Dyson, along Addison's Walk in Magdalen College. The air was crisp, trees arching overhead, and the river glimmered faintly in the moonlight. The conversation turned, as it often did, to myth. Jack loved myth, but dismissed it as lies breathed through silver. To him, stories of gods and heroes were beautiful but false, glittering illusions that could not be trusted. But Ronald stopped him. "No," he said, "myths are not lies. They're echoes. They're fragments of the true story, the story God himself is telling." He explained that in all great tales, you have sacrifice, death, resurrection. And these are shadows pointing to the one story that was real. The gospel, he told Jack, was a type of myth, but it's a myth that is true. A myth that had entered history and become true. Jack listened. He'd never heard it put that way. Myths had always stirred something deep inside of him, a longing or a joy, a sense of eternal. Could it be that Christianity was not the opposition of myth, but its fulfillment? That night, under the Oxford stars, Jack's defense began to crumble. What Ronald planted in that conversation, the spirit began to water. And in the weeks that followed, Jack Lewis, the sharp skeptic who had once scoffed at faith, would eventually bend his knees to Christ. For Jack, that conversation was a turning point, a door he thought forever would be closed. Later, he described what happened. Riding in the sidecar of his brother's motorcycle on the way to the zoo, he realized, almost without knowing how, that he believed. And later he would write, "When we set out, I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And when we reached the zoo, I did." Lewis called it being surprised by joy. But for Ronald, it was a fruit of years of friendship and faithfulness. He had watched his friend move from skepticism to belief, and now at last to Christ. From 1933 until 1949, they met regularly at the Eagle and Child Pub, as they called the Bird and Baby. There amid the smoke and the chatter, members read the manuscripts aloud, they debated ideas, they offered kind of sharp but loyal critique that only a true friend could give. Tolkien brought drafts of a legend he was writing, one that would eventually become The Lord of the Rings. Lewis brought his Christian essays, his radio talks and stories that would soon inspire millions. Around that table, voices rose and fell, laughter mixed with argument, and ideas that would shape literature for generations were hammered into form. In 1937, Tolkien nervously shared a new story. It was a tale he had written for his children, and he'd called it The Hobbit. At first, he didn't really think it was worth publishing, but Jack Lewis insisted. He praised the work and encouraged Ronald to share it with the world. That year, The Hobbit appeared in print, and almost overnight, readers fell in love with Bilbo Baggins and his unexpected journey. It was the beginning of something far greater. In those meetings with the Inklings, the friendship with Lewis, Tolkien's love story that had all been covered, Middle Earth was about to step into the world. But then, September 1939.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
War again. Nazi Germany had invaded Poland, and Britain was drawn into the fight. For Ronald Tolkien, now 47, the announcement stirred memories he could never forget. The mud, the blood, and his friends that he had lost a battle. This time, he would not wear a uniform. Instead, he was now a professor of Anglo-Saxon at Oxford. He was a husband and a father of four children, John, Michael, Christopher, and Priscilla. The war was still pressing close, because Michael enlisted in the Royal Air Force. And then his plane was shot down. In an act of God, he miraculously survived the terror of being shot down. And at the same time, Christopher was training with the Royal Navy. Every letter carried the weight of life or death. Every knock at the door sent a shiver of fear through Ronald and Edith. The war that had once belonged to his generation was now consuming his sons. Oxford, too, transformed under the shadow of war. Younger faculty and students left for the front, leaving gaps for Tolkien to fill. The school was once again quiet. And now he had new duties. He served as an air raid warden. He patrolled the streets at night during blackouts, ensuring not a single light betrayed the city to the enemy bombers. Then there was rationing. Food was scarce, fuel was limited, and even paper, which was vital for his writing, was hard to find. Edith's health during this time suffered. And yet amid all this hardship, there was something constant, the Inklings. Ronald and Jack Lewis still met, reading aloud their work, sparring with ideas, and finding strength in a fellowship. It was in these years, under the shadow of war, that Tolkien continued to write The Lord of the Rings. He denied that it was ever an allegory, but admitted the darkness of the age seeped into the story. Totalitarian power, mechanized brutality, the crushing weight of evil, all found their reflection in the story. And yet at the heart of it, he wrote of fellowship, sacrifice, and resilience. During the 1940s, while the world was gripped at war, the friendship between Ronald Tolkien and Jack Lewis deepened through their shared work as writers. Jack was turning his formidable intellect towards Christian apologetics, essays, and talks that would soon become some of the most influential works of the century. And Lewis often turned to Ronald for feedback. When he drafted the Screwtape letters, the sharp exchange between a senior demon and his apprentice, Ronald was one of the first to read it. And later, as Jack prepared the radio broadcast that would eventually become Mere Christianity, Ronald would listen, offer critique, and push him to clarify things. Their conversations were rigorous and sometimes fierce. Ronald admired Jack's passion, but he was wary of how quickly Lewis wrote and how boldly he published. Still, he respected the brilliance behind it. For Lewis, Ronald's steady Catholic faith provided a grounding influence. For Tolkien, Jack's defense of Christianity was proof of what he had long believed, that myths and stories could point people to an ultimate truth. In those war years, as bombs fell and nations trembled, two Oxford professors sat across from one another, shaping worlds that would echo far beyond the walls of Inkling gatherings. Eventually, the war ended, And thankfully, Ronald Tolkien's sons both returned home. By the mid-1950s, after years of late-night writings, endless revisions, and encouragement of his Inkling friends, Ronald Tolkien finally saw his great work published, The Lord of the Rings. It appeared in three volumes between 1954 and 1955. At first, he was worried. It was way too long, too strange, too steeped in myth. It would never find an audience. But Lewis was one of his greatest champions, urging Tolkien to finish, praising his work, and helping spread it to readers who quickly fell under its spell. Tolkien described the book as a fundamentally Catholic work, not an allegory, not a sermon, but it was a story infused with faith. He wanted to leave readers free to find truth in a tale without feeling preached to. The ring itself reflected sin, the pull of power, the pride that corrupts even the noblest heart. Sauron's shadow mirrored Satan, who twisted creation to his end. In Frodo, carrying a crushing burden for the sake of others, readers saw echoes of Christ bearing the cross. In Gandalf's fall and return as Gandalf the White, we see the mirror of the resurrection. Aragorn's healing hands marked him as the Christ-like king who restored a broken land. Tolkien exalted the meek. Hobbits were small, ordinary, and overlooked. Those were the ones he chose as the heroes of the story. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Frodo and Sam, humble and loyal, succeeded where warriors and kings failed. Their courage, born out of love and humility, carried the world to salvation. For Tolkien, mercy was just as important. Bilbo's decision to spare Gollum, Frodo's compassion in the face of betrayal, these were not accidents of storytelling. They were reflections of grace. And in the end, it was mercy that brought the ring to its destruction. War had never left Tolkien. In World War I, he had seen friends choose duty over safety, only to fall on the battlefield. The loss of Robert and Jeffrey, the endless trenches, it had all scarred him deeply. Those memories became the blasted lands of Mordor, the haunting Dread Marshes, and the fellowship of unlikely heroes bound together in loyalty and sacrifice. The courage of ordinary soldiers, the privates, the men in the mud, emerged as hobbits, small but resilient and carrying the weight of the world. In World War II, Tolkien was older, no longer a soldier but a father, and he watched his sons march into the same dangers he had once known. He carried the fear of loss with every letter that arrived from the front and from the headlines. Hitler's rise was like the Dark Lord who enslaved with fear. Frodo's burden mirrored the weight of his sons bore in the uniform. Through both wars, Tolkien's Catholic faith had anchored him. He did not write an allegory, but the battles he endured and the faith that sustained him wove themselves into every page. Good versus evil, mercy and humility triumphing over pride and power, redemption born through sacrifice. Long before Mordor, before Middle-earth had taken shape, there was a Cerhol. For the young Ronald Tolkien, it was paradise. That small rural hamlet just outside of Birmingham with rolling hills, hedgerows, and a working mill. There, with his brother Hilary, he had spent endless days exploring woods and streams, inventing stories, and letting his imagination wander. That became the Shire. Its mill, Hobbiton's Mill. Its meadows, the hobbits' beloved fields. To Ronald, that village was the lost paradise, and he carried it with him all his life. Cerhol was a lesson in loss. The Tolkien family had left when Ronald was just a boy. His mother's death had made the separation permanent. The fields and streams of his childhood were gone, and now they've been overtaken by suburbs and industry. The sense of a lost golden age saturates the Lord of the Rings. Frodo's return to the Shire, only to find out he cannot truly go back, reflects Ronald's own life, the longings, the nostalgia, and the recognition that joy in this world is always tinged with sorrow. And yet from that little village also grew hope. Its fields, its mill, its stories gave Ronald the first tastes of myth and imagination. Unlike C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, The Lord of the Rings was never meant as a Christian allegory. Tolkien resisted that idea fiercely. But he did admit that the Christian underpinnings are there. They were woven deep into the fabric of the story. His Catholic faith, the scars of World War I, the anxieties of World War II, all combined to give Middle Earth its moral weight and spiritual depth. The struggle between good and evil, the power of humility over pride, the redemptive force of mercy, and the hope that light can endure even in the darkest places. These are not just story elements. These are truths that Tolkien lived. And that's why The Lord of the Rings resonates so deeply with Christian readers, while at the same time remains open to anyone who longs for courage, sacrifice, and hope. By the 1950s, the friendship between Ronald Tolkien and Jack Lewis had shifted. Lewis's faith had grown rapidly. His books, his broadcasts, his lectures on Christianity reached audiences around the world. At times, their differences in personality and literary taste strained the closeness they'd once shared. But beneath all the friction, there was something deep, faith, respect, and the years of shared conversations that men would never forget. In 1963, Jack Lewis died. For Tolkien, it was a loss that cut deep. He wrote this about it. "So far, I have felt the normal feelings of a man of my age, like an old man that's losing all of its leaves one by one. This feels like an axe blow near the roots." Jack Lewis had been more than a colleague. He'd been a fellow pilgrim, a man who challenged him, sharpened him, and shared in the great work of pointing others toward truth through story. By 1971, Ronald and Edith Tolkien had settled into the quiet life, away from the bustle of Oxford. They were married for 55 years, bound together through war, poverty, and fame. But that November, the love of Ronald's life slipped away. Edith Tolkien died on November 29th at the age of 82. For Ronald, it was a wound deeper than any he had ever known. In a letter to their son Christopher, he confessed he felt as if he were in a strange land all alone. She'd been his partner since 1916, the woman who inspired his great love story, Berean and Lutheran, and now he faced the twilight of his years without her. Her final days, he wrote, were peaceful. There was no prolonged suffering, and that was a small comfort. But the grief was overwhelming. At her grave, he arranged for her stone to bear one single word, Lutheran. Later, when his own time came, his name would rest beside hers, marked Berean. Their love, immortalized in story, was carved into the stone. On September 2nd, 1973, at the age of 81, J.R.R. Tolkien died in a hospital. The cause was a bleeding ulcer complicated by infection. His health had been failing for some time, and though doctors tried, they could not save him. Edith had died just 2 years before, and without her, Ronald often described himself as a tree struck at the roots. Yet through all of his grief, through the loss of his wife, his friends, the long shadow of two world wars, his faith remained a steady comfort, the same faith that anchored him since childhood. He's laid to rest beside Edith at the Catholic section of the Wolvercote Cemetery in Oxford. On the stone under their names are written Lutheran and Brian, the names of the lovers from his mythology. After Tolkien died in 1973, his family carried on his legacy. His younger brother, Hilary, passed away in 1976. His eldest son, John, became a Catholic priest and served faithfully until he died in the year 2002. Michael, his second son, spent his life as a teacher before passing away in 1984. Christopher, perhaps the closest tied to his father's work, became an editor and re-edited and shaped many of his posthumous writings. He died in the year 2020. And Priscilla, Tolkien's only daughter, who had served, helping him by typing out large parts of The Lord of the Rings, later served as the vice president of the Tolkien Society. She passed away in 2022. Through them, the memory of Ronald Tolkien remained alive. They were the caretakers of his story, ensuring that his words, his faith, and his vision of Middle-earth would reach new generations. When we look at the life of J.R.R. Tolkien, we see more than a writer of fantasy. We see a man who endured loss, poverty, and war, but he never let bitterness take root. Instead, he held fast to faith, to family, to friendship. His stories remind us that the smallest act of courage, the quietest faithfulness can push back against the greatest darkness. Tolkien teaches us that our lives, like trees, are meant to be deeply rooted in God, so that no storm can uproot them. He shows us that mercy matters, that even the most broken can play a part in redemption, and that fellowship, the bonds of love and loyalty, is what helps us endure. His work endures not because there's hobbits and wizards, but because it's about us, about choosing humility over pride, hope over despair, and faith over fear. And like Tolkien himself, we are called to live lives that point upward, bear fruit, and remind the world that even in the darkest night, the light still shines. This has been the Church History Podcast. I'm your host, Laura-Lee Siemens, and today we've walked through the life of J.R.R. Tolkien. We've seen how faith, loss, and love shaped not only his stories, but his soul. And his life reminds me that my faith must be rooted deeply, so deeply that when the storms come, and they will, we can stand still. Tolkien's words, his friendship with C.S. Lewis, his devotion to God, calls me to live with courage, mercy, and hope. So the question is this: when your story is told, will your life, like Tolkien's, point others towards a light that never fades? If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. We release new content every Monday. And don't forget to check out our website at lauraleesiemens.com for more information and additional resources. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week as we continue our journey through the incredible history of the Church.